G.K. Chesterton, The Club of Queer Trades. This excellent half-parody of the detective story, particularly of the Sherlock Holmes stories, is a good introduction to the whimsical, offbeat style of G.K. Chesterton, one of the most unusual authors of British detective fiction of the late 19th and early 20th century. Chesterton, who was for a time the president of the Detection Club, to which many great British detective novelists belong, was a prolific author. Among his works of detective fiction are The Club of Queer Trades, the Father Brown stories, of which 5 books were published, and which are now also available in a single volume, and The Man Who Was Thursday, a book which combines the flavor of the detective novel with adventure, mystery, and even theology. Perhaps even The Napoleon of Notting Hill, with its unexpected turns, reminiscent of the Gothic fiction, which indirectly spawned detective fiction, could be considered part of the legacy. On the other hand, nearly all of Chesterton's novels and short stories bear a slightly surrealistic mark, although they are by no means unrealistic. Perhaps it is his common sense which makes his story seem surreal at points, for common sense is by no means common. Chesterton was wary of the mechanistic tendencies of the early 20th century. His London of the 1980s, portrayed in The Napoleon of Notting Hill, still used horse-drawn hansom cabs. In the second chapter of The Club of Queer Trades, Lord Beaumont asks the protagonist, "Are you a modern, Basil?" "No," said Basil loudly and cheerfully. In fact, Chesterton uses the adjective modern with consistently negative connotations. It is clear that inhabitants of this modern world are not all enamored of its modernity. Even those who cannot do without their cars, CD players, and computers still buy millions of books of fantasy each year. Not surprisingly, many of them also enjoy Chesterton's whimsical, he would vigorously deny being a reactionary, style. Table of Contents. Chapter 1. The Tremendous Adventures of Major Brown. Chapter 2. The Painful Fall of a Great Reputation. Chapter 3. The Awful Reason of the Vicar's Visit. Chapter 4. The Singular Speculation of the House Agent. Chapter 5. The Noticeable Conduct of Professor Chadd. Chapter 6. The Eccentric Seclusion of the Old Lady. This document is from the Christian Classics Ethereal Library at Calvin College. On the web, www.ccel.org. Chapter 1. The Tremendous Adventures of Major Brown. Rabelais, or his wild illustrator, Gustave Dore, must have had something to do with the designing of the things called flats in England and America. There is something entirely gargantuan in the idea of economizing space by piling houses on top of each other, front doors and all. And in the chaos and complexity of these perpendicular streets, anything may dwell or happen. And it is in one of them, I believe, that the inquirer may find the offices of the Club of Queer Trades. It may be thought at the first glance that the name would attract and startle the passer-by, but nothing attracts or startles in these dim, immense hives. The passer-by is only looking for his own melancholy destination, the Montenegro Shipping Agency, or the London office of the Rutland Sentinel, and passes through the twilight passages as one passes through the twilight corridors of a dream. If the thugs set up a stranger's assassination company in one of the great buildings in Norfolk Street, and sent in a mild man in spectacles to answer inquiries, no inquiries would be made. And the Club of Queer Trades reigns in a great edifice hidden like a fossil in a mighty cliff of fossils. The nature of this society, such as we afterwards discovered it to be, is soon and simply told. It is an eccentric and bohemian club, of which the absolute condition of membership lies in this: that the candidate must have invented the method by which he earns his living. It must be an entirely new trade. The exact definition of this requirement is given in the two principal rules. First, it must not be a mere application or variation of an existing trade. Thus, for instance, the club would not admit an insurance agent, simply because instead of insuring men's furniture against being burnt in a fire, he insured, let us say, their trousers against being torn by a mad dog. The principal, as Sir Bradcock Burnaby Bradcock, in the extraordinarily eloquent and soaring speech to the club on the occasion of the question being raised in the Stormby Smith affair, said wittily and keenly, is the same. Secondly, the trade must be a genuine commercial source of income, the support of its inventor. Thus, the club would not receive a man simply because he chose to pass his days collecting broken sardine tins, unless he could drive a roaring trade in them. Professor Chick made that quite clear. And when one remembers what Professor Chick's own new trade was, one doesn't know whether to laugh or cry. The discovery of this strange society was a curiously refreshing thing. To realize that there were 10 new trades in the world was like looking at the first ship or the first plow. It made a man feel what he should feel, that he was still in the childhood of the world. That I should have come at last upon so singular a body was, I may say without vanity, not altogether singular. For I have a mania for belonging to as many societies as possible. I may be said to collect clubs, and I have accumulated a vast and fantastic variety of specimens ever since. In my audacious youth, I collected the Athenaeum. At some future day, perhaps, I may tell tales of some of the other bodies to which I have belonged. I will recount the doings of the Dead Man's Shoes Society, that superficially immoral but darkly justifiable communion. I will explain the curious origin of the Cat and Christian, the name of which has been so shamefully misinterpreted. And the world shall know at last why the Institute of Typewriters coalesced with the Red Tulip League. Of the 10 teacups, of course, I dare not say a word. The first of my revelations, at any rate, shall be concerned with the Club of Queer Trades, which, as I have said, was one of this class, one which I was almost bound to come across sooner or later because of my singular hobby. The wild youth of the metropolis call me facetiously the King of Clubs. They also call me the Cherub, in allusion to the roseate and youthful appearance I have presented in my declining years. I only hope the spirits in the better world have as good dinners as I have. But the finding of the Club of Queer Trades has one very curious thing about it. The most curious thing about it is that it was not discovered by me. It was discovered by my friend Basil Grant, a stargazer, a mystic, and a man who scarcely stirred out of his attic. Very few people knew anything of Basil, not because he was in the least unsociable, for if a man out of the street had walked into his rooms, he would have kept him talking till morning. Few people knew him because, like all poets, he could do without them. He welcomed a human face as he might welcome a sudden blend of color in a sunset. But he no more felt the need of going out to parties than he felt the need of altering the sunset clouds. He lived in a queer and comfortable garret in the roofs of Lambeth. He was surrounded by a chaos of things that were in odd contrast to the slums around him. Old, fantastic books, swords, armor, the whole dust hole of romanticism. But his face, amid all these quixotic relics, appeared curiously keen and modern, a powerful, legal face. And no one but I knew who he was. Long ago as it is, everyone remembers the terrible and grotesque scene that occurred in when one of the most acute and forcible of the English judges suddenly went mad on the bench. I had my own view of that occurrence, but about the facts themselves there is no question at all. For some months, indeed for some years, people had detected something curious in the judge's conduct. He seemed to have lost interest in the law, in which he had been beyond expression brilliant and terrible as a KC, and to be occupied in giving personal and moral advice to the people concerned. He talked more like a priest or a doctor, and a very outspoken one at that. The first thrill was probably given when he said to a man who had attempted a crime of passion, "I sentence you to 3 years imprisonment under the firm and solemn and God-given conviction that what you require is 3 months at the seaside." He accused criminals from the bench not so much of their obvious legal crimes, but of things that had never been heard of in a court of justice: monstrous egoism, lack of humor, and morbidity deliberately encouraged. Things came to a head in that celebrated diamond case in which the Prime Minister himself, that brilliant patrician, had to come forward, gracefully and reluctantly, to give evidence against his valet. After the detailed life of the household had been thoroughly exhibited, the judge requested the Premier again to step forward, which he did with quiet dignity. The judge then said in a sudden grating voice, "Get a new soul. That thing's not fit for a dog. Get a new soul." All this, of course, in the eyes of the sagacious, was premonitory of that melancholy and farcical day when his wits actually deserted him in open court. It was a libel case between two very eminent and powerful financiers, against both of whom charges of considerable defalcation were brought. The case was long and complex. The advocates were long and eloquent. But at last, after weeks of work and rhetoric, the time came for the great judge to give a summing up. And one of his celebrated masterpieces of lucidity and pulverizing logic was scarcely looked for. He had spoken very little during the prolonged affair, and he looked sad and lowering at the end of it. He was silent for a few moments and then burst into a stentorian song. His remarks, as reported, were as follows. "Oh, routy, outy, tiddly, outy, tiddly, outy, tiddly, outy, highty, lighty, tiddly, ity, tiddly, ity, ow." He then retired from public life and took the garret in Lambeth. I was sitting there one evening about 6 o'clock over a glass of that gorgeous burgundy which he kept behind a pile of black-letter folios. He was striding about the room, fingering, after a habit of his, one of the great swords in his collection. The red glare of the strong fire struck his square features and his fierce gray hair. His blue eyes were even unusually full of dreams, and he had opened his mouth to speak dreamily, when the door was flung open and a pale, fiery man with red hair and huge furred overcoat swung himself panting into the room. "Sorry to bother you, Basil," he gasped. "I took a liberty, made an appointment here with a man, a client, in 5 minutes. I beg your pardon, sir." And he gave me a bow of apology. Basil smiled at me. "You didn't know," he said, "that I had a practical brother. This is Rupert Grant, Esquire, who can and does all there is to be done. Just as I was a failure at one thing, he is a success at everything. I remember him as a journalist, a house agent, a naturalist, an inventor, a publisher, a schoolmaster. What are you now, Rupert?" "I am and have been for some time," said Rupert with some dignity, "a private detective. And there's my client." A loud rap at the door had cut him short, and on permission being given, the door was thrown sharply open, and a stout, dapper man walked swiftly into the room, set his silk hat with a clap on the table, and said, "Good evening, gentlemen," with a stress on the last syllable that somehow marked him out as a martinet, military, literary, and social. He had a large head streaked with black and gray, and an abrupt black mustache, which gave him a look of fierceness which was contradicted by his sad, sea-blue eyes. Basil immediately said to me, "Let us come into the next room, Gully," and was moving towards the door, but the stranger said, "Not at all. Friends remain. Assistance, possibly." The moment I heard him speak, I remembered who he was, a certain Major Brown I had met years before in Basil's society. I had forgotten altogether the black, dandified figure and the large, solemn head, but I remembered the peculiar speech, which consisted of only saying about a quarter of each sentence, and that sharply, like the crack of a gun. I do not know. It may have come from giving orders to troops. Major Brown was a V.C. and an able and distinguished soldier, but he was anything but a warlike person. Like many among the iron men who recovered British India, he was a man with the natural beliefs and tastes of an old maid. In his dress he was dapper and yet demure. In his habits he was precise to the point of the exact adjustment of a teacup. One enthusiasm he had, which was the nature of a religion, the cultivation of pansies. And when he talked about his collection, his blue eyes glittered like a child's at a new toy, the eyes that had remained untroubled when the troops were roaring victory round Roberts at Kandahar. "Well, Major," said Rupert Grant with a lordly heartiness, flinging himself into a chair, "what is the matter with you?" "Yellow pansies, coal cellar, P.G. Northover," said the Major with righteous indignation. We glanced at each other with inquisitiveness. Basil, who had his eyes shut in his abstracted way, said simply, "I beg your pardon." "Fact is, street, you know, man, pansies, on wall, death to me, something, preposterous." We shook our heads gently, bit by bit, and mainly by the seemingly sleepy assistance of Basil Grant, we pieced together the Major's fragmentary but excited narration. It would be infamous to submit the reader to what we endured. Therefore, I will tell the story of Major Brown in my own words. But the reader must imagine the scene. The eyes of Basil closed as in a trance, after his habit, and the eyes of Rupert and myself getting rounder and rounder as we listened to one of the most astounding stories in the world, from the lips of the little man in black, sitting bolt upright in his chair and talking like a telegram. Major Brown was, I have said, a successful soldier, but by no means an enthusiastic one. So far from regretting his retirement on half pay, it was with delight that he took a small, neat villa, very like a doll's house, and devoted the rest of his life to pansies and weak tea. The thought that battles were over when he had once hung up his sword in the little front hall, along with two patent stew pots and a bad watercolor, and betaken himself instead to wielding the rake in his little sunlit garden, was to him like having come into a harbor in heaven. He was Dutch-like and precise in his taste in gardening, and had, perhaps, some tendency to drill his flowers like soldiers. He was one of those men who are capable of putting four umbrellas in the stand rather than three, so that two may lean one way and two another. He saw life like a pattern in a freehand drawing book, and assuredly he would not have believed or even understood anyone who had told him that within a few yards of his brick paradise he was destined to be caught in a whirlpool of incredible adventure, such as he had never seen or dreamed of in the horrible jungle or the heat of battle. One certain bright and windy afternoon, the Major, attired in his usual faultless manner, had set out for his usual constitutional. In crossing from one great residential thoroughfare to another, he happened to pass along one of those aimless-looking lanes which lie along the back garden walls of a row of mansions, and which, in their empty and discolored appearance, give one an odd sensation as of being behind the scenes of a theater. But mean and sulky as the scene might be in the eyes of most of us, it was not altogether so in the Major's, for along the coarse gravel footway was coming a thing which was to him what the passing of a religious procession is to a devout person. A large, heavy man with fish-blue eyes and a ring of irradiating red beard was pushing before him a barrow, which was ablaze with incomparable flowers. There were splendid specimens of almost every order, but the Major's own favorite pansies predominated. The Major stopped and fell into conversation, and then into bargaining. He treated the man after the manner of collectors and other madmen, that is to say, he carefully and with a sort of anguish selected the best roots from the less excellent, praised some, disparaged others, made a subtle scale ranging from a thrilling worth and rarity to a degraded insignificance, and then bought them all. The man was just pushing off his barrel when he stopped and came close to the major.